I bet that all research sites deal with the similar challenges and issues with their PIs, patients, sponsors, and CRO companies. Today, we're going to talk about some of those challenges. I'm Anna.
I'm Alexandria.
And this is The Tea in STEM. Alexandria and I are here to talk to the lead coordinator of a research site that specializes in phase 2, 3, 4 studies in the field of allergy, asthma, immunology, gastroenterology, oncology adjacent, and interventional radiology. Brittany, welcome back. This is the second episode of us talking to you about challenges.
It is great to be back.
Okay, so we left off with, have you ever faced a situation with a CRO, a sponsor, where they requested something that seemed entirely absurd or a total waste of time? Does any ideas come to mind?
I feel like sometimes the communication that they require is a bit much. It depends on what the situation is, but recruitment, the constant nagging, even if you have patients in their studies where they are reaching out to you what it seems like every day. I know it's not every day, but it's like, okay, well, I've got a good amount of patients in your study. You know, you got to give me some room to breathe.
Right. Like, there's this thing that's going on. The CROs are requesting the sponsors are requesting the CRAs to follow up with your low enrollment sites, you know, weekly, monthly, every 2 weeks, whatever it is. But all of the sponsors and CRAs are doing this, regardless of how many patients you have in your study. We're just doing a recruitment follow-up call. Leave me alone. I've said this in so many meetings that we've had with sponsors, like, if I'm not messing up, leave me alone. Don't follow up with me. Just give me the contact information so I can call you if I need something, because you're taking away valuable time that I have. I'm only here for 8 hours. I'd love to spend at least 2 hours of that a day recruiting for your study.
Right. Instead of answering all the calls from all the people, you know, different people from the study that are calling to check in, there could be multiple people that are asking the same question. Because they come from different parts of the study. Sponsors sometimes are the ones reaching out of nowhere. And you're like, okay, well, I hope that this gets to the CRA. And then the next day, CRA emails the same thing.
And you're like, did you not just talk to your counterpart?
Or at least CC the people that you work with.
The whole team.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I so agree with this. Like, I understand that they have to have purpose. They have to have a job to do, too. But let me do mine.
Right.
You know, another thing that's really absurd, since we're on the topic here, is sponsors and CROs, CROs influencing the sponsors. Like, all your sites should do consenting this way. You know, buy our forms, or let us train the sites on this, like, tablet of how we're going to do electronic consenting and whatnot. And then come to the sites and say, this is mandatory. It comes from the sponsor. You have to do your consenting this way. It totally disrupts our SOPs. It's for this one study, we have to do their consenting process differently. I think it's completely absurd.
I agree.
You know what? It's bullshit.
Well, we talk all the time about, and it's not just in research, in every field, especially in STEM, repeatability and consistency is key. Errors happen when you start to break those SOPs and your norms. That's when mistakes happen. And you're asking us to break our SOPs and break our norm for one study and not expecting any errors. We have our SOPs and our trainings in place because that's how we want it done every single time. So we don't miss any of those important touch points.
Yeah.
There, we were just listening to somebody discuss an audit, and they were saying that some of the biggest findings in FDA audits is when sites don't follow their SOPs because there is a different protocol in place for the sponsors or that vendor, and they're being told not to follow their SOPs and to follow this vendor for convenience. And then they end up missing important points because that communication isn't going full circle.
Right. I think that goes with multiple things that some studies implement that can throw a wrench into SOPs and how we flow through visits that, like Alexandria said, can lead to these errors or missing things that you normally wouldn't if you were able to follow the SOPs that you do every single day.
I know. Why are we as sites letting them take our flow away? I don't know the better word to use right now, but like, why are we giving them that kind of control?
Yeah. And for people listening who maybe want to be involved in research studies, the site's whole purpose is to make that experience for the patient and to collect that data and make it accurate. And we're going to make that experience not as good for the patient when we're not following our processes and our flow and making sure that we give everything we can to the patient as well. So not only are you disrupting our workday, but you're going to disrupt how the patient is interpreting research and potentially the overall view of clinical research in the society.
You know, just as you're mentioning, okay, here's another absurd point. When sponsors or CROs take away the site's privilege to pay the patient, instead of like, okay, thank you so much, you know, here's your reimbursement for your time today, here's a check, here's a Venmo right now in real time, they want to do it through a third-party company that pays all patients the second Monday of the month. And you're like, okay, great, so this patient's had two visits, they're due like, I don't know, $150, but you ain't going to get paid till next month on the second Monday. What kind of BS is that?
Yeah, I've experienced that too. And sometimes with those third-party vendors, things happen. You know, they're already waiting for their payment, and then they have to wait longer because who knows, it's taking extra time to process, or if they're using some kind of electronic payment system, the patient can't access it, that type of thing. So I think taking away the site's power to be able to pay them up front.
Yeah.
It's just
another waste of time is when the sponsors or the CROs ask the PI to be involved in every single meeting, whether it's a recruitment call meeting or we've just updated our manual for blah, blah, blah. Let's get everybody on the call for this.
Right.
Most PIs, if they're not university based, they're running their own practice. They only want to be called by the sponsor when it's a patient-focused situation.
Right.
You know, or something major in the protocol that has changed and they need their input on, or something of that sort.
And it's not for lack of the PI caring or having that oversight. It's because they are busy doing that oversight. They are busy looking at all the patient charts, helping to recruit from their database, doing surgeries, seeing their patients. They're busy with all the PI and physician stuff, and now you want to bog them down with meetings? Anna was just talking about how she's only here for 8 hours a day. Most physicians are working 12 to 16 already, especially if they run their own practice. And that is fully booked usually between pharma reps, research visits, and regular visits and surgeries. And now you want them to push one of those things aside to have a meeting that doesn't help with any of those.
Right. Or even, you know, sometimes they'll be like, oh, well, you know, maybe they can hop on during their lunch. Like, no, that's
let when them have their lunch.
Let them take a break.
Yeah. I know one of our PIs, like, I don't think I've ever seen that person take a bathroom break ever. It's ridiculous. They just keep going and going and going. There's no room for it. All right. We could probably go on a whole hour of this, but let's move on a little bit. So you've worked at a few research sites over the years. Without naming any names, could you tell us a time where the PI was out of line, and how did you handle that situation?
I feel like PI out of line, I haven't necessarily experienced too much. I've experienced more on the other spectrum where they're not even present enough to be out of line. Does that make sense? So you're kind of, you know, it's those doctors that already have one foot out the door. They are like, I did research for a billion years. I know how this goes. You guys take care of everything. I'm just here.
Yeah.
And so I think that's more what I've experienced so far. But I will say I've experienced, you know, really great PI oversight, PIs that make themselves so available whenever you need to, despite having those crazy schedules. But I'd be interested, you know, if you have any stories about some PIs that stepped out of lane.
Oh my gosh. All right, let's take you back to like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Right, okay? Before the turn of the century.
Before the turn of the century.
At Robert.
Yeah, so I did. This PI had a habit of any time that one of the coordinators were presented with a question from a CRA, a monitor, that they would like jump in. You know, you'd hear them walking over to our office and then the PI walking up behind, right? And the sponsor would ask like a simple question of like, do you know why this patient was a day late on coming into their visit? And as you're about to answer, this PI would jump in and be like, oh, well, see, we started the visit on time, but then she had to leave. And so then we had to make up, have her bring come back the next day to finish it. So technically that's not a deviation. Everything was done fine. So every single time the PI would jump in and try to protect her coordinators, or maybe it was more along the lines of like protect the data. I think she started this initial fear of protocol deviations being a bad thing. And they're really not a bad thing. I mean, we could talk about that another time too. But yeah, so I mean, that was one of the more I would consider like an out-of-line situation. But out of all the PIs that I've ever worked for, they've all been, besides this particular one, even that one was on top of it. Like that PI's oversight was 100%. Always involved in every single visit, you know, a little helicoptery maybe, but all of them have been really on top of being a part of the studies.
I agree. Besides the one I mentioned before, all of the PIs that I've worked for are fully invested in research.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of those one-offs.
Yeah.
Where he just had too much on his plate and was ready to have nothing on his plate.
Yeah, right. One foot out the door.
Right.
Let's just close this up. Yeah. Okay. So what are some challenges that you face frequently when it comes to patients?
Ooh, a few things. I think one of the main things is getting them comfortable with the idea of research in general. If they've never been in research, making them feel like it's not, I used to get guinea pig all the time, where it's like, okay, well, can you explain to me, like, what are you going to do to me?
Guinea pig is a dirty word, okay? It's a dirty word
to us
research folk. We should have a guinea pig jar, like how they have the curse jar or the swear jar.
Yeah.
Guinea pig jar.
I know. I ran, you know, I've experienced things where patients who were struggling to afford their treatment were offered clinical research and denied it, even though we explained, you know, you would be getting treatment. Even in this particular case, he wouldn't have even gotten placebo. He would have been getting
active
treatment. But the idea of research turned him off immediately. And so I think that's where I've found a lot of little bumps. But once you can get through to a patient, once they're willing to listen and accept the information that you can give them, I find it's much easier to get through to them. But it's just that initial stigma.
And that makes a lot of sense, too, because if you look at the history of research, which Anna and I have touched on, there's a lot of times where things haven't gone a good way before there was agencies to make sure that people were protected. But, you know, things are a little different nowadays, and you always, you know, want to vet out your physicians and your sites, but that doesn't mean research is bad. And fun fact, there's a couple different research communities and, like, nonprofits that are trying to do, like, a Got Milk version campaign for research to make it more mainstream and household thing to be happening.
Definitely want to be a part of the Got Milk ads for research because, I mean, we keep telling everybody about that, too. I would say, and I've been doing this for, I've lost count after 13 years. I don't even know what number of years we're on yet. So anyways, 95% of patients that have completed start to finish a study have been upset at their last visit. I'm not going to see you guys anymore. I've never been taken care of so well. No one's actually cared to like look at my labs, trend them, review them, and talk to me about them. Like, I've never had so much, you know, checking in and making sure I'm okay from a care facility before. That's why we have repeat research patients that are desperate to do anything for us, because we do such a good job at taking care of them. And I like to tell people that when it's their first time, I said, watch, I bet you anything, by the time you're through with this study, whether or not you liked the drug, you're going to love the care.
Right. That was always what I led with, too, was the amount of care that you'll be getting. I've worked in clinics where people wait an hour, if not more, to see the doctor to get their treatment. But if they were with research,
you're in.
You got somebody with you the entire way, getting you straight to the doctor. Whereas in, you know, if you're just a regular patient in the clinic, if you have an issue, you try to call, I don't know, their assistant or the front desk, and you kind of hope that they go and talk to the doctor. Versus if you have a contact at research and you're a research patient, we're going to get right on it for you.
Yeah, we don't have a waiting room.
Right.
The last research place, we removed our waiting room. I asked them to. There's no point to it.
Yeah.
Because your coordinator is at the door waiting for you to walk in so we can start our stuff right now.
Exactly.
And we respect your time because it is a little bit quicker or it's a little bit longer than a normal visit sometimes. But then again, there's no waiting. So it doesn't feel like an hour has passed because we're nonstop, you know, diving into everything that we have to get done.
And we have snacks.
And that is true.
At our research center, we feed you.
I have worked at a lot of, one of the previous research centers I worked for was in a really big clinic, and we had snacks for our patients too. And people caught wind of it
because
the normal clinic didn't have snacks.
Yeah.
And they were like, the patients would like come and knock on our door and they'd be like, I heard you guys have snacks in here.
Okay, so one of the challenges that I think that I face with patients is, and I think this is a fine-tuned skill that you get to learn over your years, is that you can't educate the patients all the same way. So when it comes to, like, how do you take the drug, some people need a visual, some people need it written down, some people need to have it said to them, shown, and then they need to practice. It's, you know, all different. Same with the ePro devices. We've had it before where the sponsor gave us like a flip chart of showing images and wording, and then you had somebody present it of how the diary works. Yeah, it was boring, and these patients thought it was boring, but that was one of the best studies that we had for people knowing how to answer the diaries and like what to do with them, because it was in three ways. You had a presenter, they had something they could read, something tangible they could hold, and they had images.
So I do like, just going off that, when sponsors have multiple routes of educating patients.
Yeah.
So I've had some where they gave us a tablet specifically loaded with the videos that they can watch. So I used to recruit in office more than over the phone. So I guess this might just depend on how you're recruiting patients, but we would get a call from the doctor, and I would just grab my iPad, go over there, give them a tiny spiel, and be like, here, watch this video. And a lot of them really liked that.
I've never had that. I've had it where they want all the patients to understand how the inhaler works the same way. So at our third step in our screening process, our screening appointment was to play the video. And then we had to play it at the next visit and at the next visit, so everybody understood how the inhaler worked. But I've never had it that way. Like a presentation about the study. I mean, we've had presentations about informed consent, you know, but that's, we've used that for an ASCENT before. ASCENT, for anybody that doesn't know, is like for like adolescents. So it's just in a different language type for them. But we've had like a little video on, you know, here's what your ICF looks like, but not like a presentation about the study.
Yeah, I like
I think
that one.
Freaking awesome.
It was good. And even if I didn't get to play it for them at, you know, their pre-screening or whatever, at screening before they consent, so they get me going through the ICF plus this video that explains it, really gives them confidence in trusting what they're signing up for.
Yeah. You know what? I have to comment on that because they always ask us, like, what advertisement materials, what patient handout materials are, you know, are beneficial to you. I think having all of them available and letting sites to pick ahead of time what works for them.
Yes, I agree. Because I know some people don't like it, but I love those little flip charts that they sometimes give you for informed consents. I don't know if many people have run into it, but it's kind of like you run through each page is each section of the ICF, just shortened with pictures, and it streamlines the informed consent process, at least when I was at least learning how to consent. It really helped me learn how to summarize.
Yeah. So I've used those for the ASCENS, for the adolescents, but I've never used them for adults. I think I just have, like, my spiel down and, like, our little FDA points that we need to make. But what I've used is for the flip chart is for the ePRO device, especially when it's, like, sprung up on you that your research assistant is supposed to be explaining how the diary works, and she just hands it to him and goes, here you go, here's your questions.
Right.
Okay, this was like 9 years ago maybe, right, when this happened. I can remember it like it was yesterday. Her whole job was electronic. Her whole job. We were overwhelmed in electronics. And we needed to bring somebody on, like, just learn them, right? She was there for like 6 months. I'm like, okay, now you're ready to go. Here's your first patient you're going to do by yourself. And she literally just handed him the device. Just make a password or something, and then it should be good to go. Your whole job is to learn how to use this and teach people so your coordinator doesn't have to, so she can focus on the freaking important part
of getting
them into the study.
It's not even just how to use it. It's what you can expect while you're using it.
Yeah. Makes me miss paper sometimes, but oh well. Anyways, Brittany, thank you so much again. This was awesome. I really appreciate you spending your time with us for today's conversation about challenges in the research space.
Of course, anytime.
Yeah, thank you, Brittany. And I'm sure we'll have you back again for random little other things. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Let us know if there's anything you'd like to hear and subscribe.